do over the course of the next few weeks, with your permission, is something we have never tackled before, and that is Megillat Eicha. We haven't tackled Megillat Eicha for a host of reasons, but none of them are very meaningful. And there you go. Yeah, there's. Yeah, I gave you two pages there. What? This is something. Yeah. This is all. Yeah. Okay. So. I'd like to introduce Megillat Eicha, and we're today going to do some introductory material and look at the structure of Eicha, some of the unique features of the structure of Eicha, which speak directly to its message. And I'd like to pose a question which we will not answer until we complete it. We may take us till after Tisha B'Av, but Eicha will still be in Tanakh even after Tisha B'Av. That's the rumors that I've heard, and as such, it will still be a relevant thing for us to study. The question that I want to file away is, why is Eicha in Tanakh? Now, when we speak of Tanakh, what kind of literature are we referring to? What sort of literature is Tanakh? And so the answer is, no one single answer. Is Tanakh includes narrative history, Tanakh includes prophecies, Tanakh includes poetry and song. Tanakh also includes something that we call wisdom literature, such as Kohelet and Mishlei and Eov, and parts of Tehillim. Tanakh also includes something that we would best call expressive literature. And the two, although there are pieces in many books of Tanakh that could be categorized this way, the two books that are exclusively expressive literature are Shir HaShirim and Eicha. Shir HaShirim expressing tremendous longing and love and desire, and more than that. And Eicha, which of course is pretty much on the opposite side of the spectrum, expressing feelings of desperation, of wonderment at tragedy, etc. And Eicha and Eov, which could easily be conflated because they both are dealing with tragedy, are two very different books. Eov being part of Safrut HaChokhma, or wisdom literature, is dealing on a more philosophic or theological approach, trying to understand why God works the way he does. And you might even just, if you wanted to put one word as a definition of what Eov is, it's why. Why does that happen? If you were to look at Eicha, it would just take the title of Eicha and say how. Not how in the mechanical sense of how did the walls fall down, but really how could such a thing happen? The wonderment of it. The amazement of it. And so just by way of a quick introduction, Eicha, which is not called Eicha by the Chachamim referred to this book as keynote. Even though one could argue that the only chapter that is really a kina in the way that we know it is the fifth chapter, and seems to open up into keynote. And if you think about Tisha B'Av at night, we read the five chapters of Eicha, and after the fifth chapter, we immediately go into keynote, which ape the fifth chapter. And pick on the phrases from the fifth chapter, Nachlatinu Hayal Zarim, Or Ilanu, etc. It picks up on that and moves forward. Nonetheless, the entire book really is a kina. We'll talk about that in the sense of structure. So one quick word about it, and then we'll go into the notes that we have here, is that narrative in Tanakh can be presented in pretty much whatever form it will be. And as we know, psukim that are longer than five words, with very few exceptions, are going to be broken up into two parts using the etnachta mark. That's the mark that we use as a pause to reflect two parts of an idea: when something happened and what happened, who spoke and what he said, etc., what he said and what he answered. And that's part of narrative. However, the two parts can be very imbalanced. For instance, in Breishit Lamed Hey, you have a pasuk. It has one word, which is the first half of the pasuk, Vayisau, boom, and then Vayichitat Elohim Al Kol Ha'arim V'Lo Hafroch Bnei Yaakov. Long second half, because that's the way that the narrative works. They traveled, and this is what happened. In poetry, it doesn't work that way. Poetry is built on parallelism and is built on meter, and as such, the two halves of the pasuk in poetry are balanced. As a matter of fact, Hebrew poetry has no concern whatsoever with rhyme. Modern Hebrew poetry does. Tanakh doesn't have any concern with rhyme. Has tremendous concern with meter. And so therefore you will have two halves of pasuk which match each other in meter. Ashrei Yoshevei Beitecha Od Yehalelucha. Tzela is not part of the pasuk, of course. Ashrei ha'am shekach halo, ashrei ha'am shadonai lohav. Right, it'll be metered. Part of the reason for that is because it's typically going to be presented chorally in an antiphonal way with song back and forth. There is a particular kind of meter which is deliberately off balance, and that is called kinah meter or dirge meter, in which the two halves of the pasuk are not of equal amount, which is reflective of the fact that things are out of whack. And therefore, you'll take a look and you will see that the first two chapters of Eicha and the fourth chapter, which are similar in particular style, long, long, long psukim, are all imbalanced. And let's take a look for an example. Take a look at page 2 for a minute, and you'll see that in the first half, in the first pasuk. Eicha yashvav adad ha'ir rabati amayta ka'almana. And even though ideal-wise it's divided into two, the two halves are not really even in their measure. Look at the second pasuk, an even better example. Bachotiv kebalayla v'dimata al lechia en lamenachem mikol ohaveha, a long first half. Second half koreya bagduva yulal oivim, a short second half. The one has three long sticks. The second has two short sticks. So it's and deliberately written that way. So for Chazal to refer to the entire book as Kinot, even though again thematically we really only pick up on the last chapter for the themes of Kinot, nonetheless we later invoke some of the earlier themes. Stylistically and poetically, the entire thing is really written as a Kinah. Now we are all familiar with the fact that the division of chapters of Tanakh. He is a Christian division. There is no such thing as chapter divisions in Hebrew Tanakh. Chazal are not familiar with chapter divisions. And we also know that often the chapter divisions wreak havoc with the text. The best example of that is Shir HaShirim, where the chapter marks just in the middle of a parsha, in the middle of an idea, and it's quite disruptive to the text. However, Eicha is probably the clearest example, even more than Tehillim, of a book in which the chapter divisions are inherent and obvious. And that's because Eicha is built on acrostics, almost all of them. They're all 22 psukim, and I'll explain what I mean because the third chapter is 66 psukim. But the first four chapters are all alphabetic acrostics, sort of. They're all abecedarian acrostics, but sort of. The third chapter is a unique form of that, in which instead of there being an aleph and a bet and a gimel, there's three alephs, three bets, three gimels, so it's 66 psukim, but also following in the order of the alphabet. However, all those psukim are short. They're all very short. Boom. So, in reality, the three aleph psukim together are about the size of one of the psukim in Perak Aleph. So, if you think about it, when somebody reads Perek Gimel, unless they use that special tune that, I don't know if any of you know the special tune, there's a special tune used in some communities just for Perek Gimel, but if you read it with the regular tune, it just sounds like a pasuk with three etnachtas. And the length is, the guy doesn't get more stage time, if you will, than the guy reading Aleph or Bet. It's about the same, but it's three psukim instead of one.
Why does it have a special tune?
It has a special tune because, first of all, because of the fact that it's three psukim. So they read the three psukim as one pasuk with a special tune. So that it goes da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da. And so the third pasuk is the one that then it resolves. I actually have a recording of it from last year at Herodion. I was sitting there with my phone and I recorded it. It wasn't great, but it's a very, very haunting tune, especially when you're at Herodion. But we're going to take a little bit later at the structure of the Prakim. One famous note to deal with, and we'll look at it in this introductory piece, is that the order of the alphabet is a little bit dicey. Because in the first parak, you of course have the regular order of the alphabet. In the second, third, and fourth Prakim, the Pei and the Ayin are reversed. It's a very famous reversal, the Pei Ayin reversal. We'll talk about what that may mean. And the fifth parak, interestingly, has mid-sized psukim, longer than the ones in Gimel, but much shorter than the ones in Aleph, Bet, and Dalet, and it's not an alphabetic acrostic. It's Zohar Adonai Hayalanu, Abito Reit Karpatenu, and it goes through different sentiments, not in seemingly not in any across the type of order. So I have to figure out what's going on with that. The last note about this, before we look at the sources, is that we'll look at the sources, we'll see this directly. In a famous Braita that we've seen in other contexts, the Braita in Bava Batra, at the end of the first parak, that is the foundational text about the canonization of the Tanakh, goes through two pieces. One is the proper order of the books of Tanakh. If you're writing a Tanakh in scroll of Ketuvim, what's the proper order the Ketuvim should be in? And the Rambam actually paskens this, the Chot Sefer Torah. And the second thing is much more controversial. We dealt with it a couple years ago when we talked about Yura Hasid and his whole interesting shita about post-Mosaic editions, is who wrote the different books. And that's where the whole famous machloka about the last eight psukim and Yoshua, etc., comes in. In our context, Sidran Shel Ketuvim, source one, is Rut v'Sefer Tov. By the way, if you open up a regular Tanakh, you will not see this. Rut, Tehillim, Iov, Mishlei, Kohelet, Shir Hashirim, Kinot, Kinot is Eicha, Daniel, Umigilat Esther, Ezra, Divrei Hayamim. What order is this following? Because it's not the order that we have in our Tanakhim. What's the order here? First is Rut, then Tehillim, then Iov, then Mishlei, then Kohelet, then Shir Hashirim. It's simply chronological.
We don't know what
based on when, according to the author of this Braita, particular characters either lived or wrote. So Rut being ascribed to Shmuel, Tehillim being ascribed, according to the author of this Braita, as being compiled by David being the last author of Tehillim and the compiler, the Norton of Tehillim, if you will. Iov, huge machloket, and this is the jumping off point for the long discussion about when Iov lived, and so the notion that Iov lived sometime during the First Temple period. Mishlei, Kohelet, Shir Hashirim, all being ascribed to whom? Chazal say to Chizkiyahu v'siyato. Chizkiyahu, the king, and that's about the end of the northern kingdom. During that time, he's the king in the south, about the year 715 or so BCE, 710 BCE, that he's credited with the one who as being the one who assembles this, according to this Braita. Kinot being ascribed to whom? Yirmiyahu, Kinot being Echa. And then Daniel, Megillat Esther, Ezra, Divrei Hayamim are all either from the interregnum or else from the Second Temple period. And in the second half of the Braita, which is the one that gets into all the interesting controversial stuff, which is who wrote it, Yirmiyahu katab sifro v'sefer melachim v'kinot. So Yirmiyahu is credited with being the author of Sefer Yirmiyahu, which actually Sefer Yirmiyahu tells us a little bit not that way, because who actually wrote Sefer Yirmiyahu? Yirmiyahu tells us Baruch ben Neriah, his scribe, was writing it, but actually the book is authored by Yirmiyahu. Melachim is credited to Yirmiyahu, and Echa is credited to Yirmiyahu. Now why is Echa credited to Yirmiyahu? There's several reasons. So that we need a little bit of a historic background to get a sense of where Echa is coming from. And it could be that we're only going to get through the introductory piece today, but that's also of great value. Why? Yeah.
What is a Megillah and what makes something?
That is. So the historic. Sorry, what again? Divrei Hakdama, Kumi Roni Balayla. Yeah, Kumi Roni Balayla, which is the title on this on the series here that I put, is a pasuk in Perek Bet. Kumi Roni Balayla, get up and sing at night. And this leads to Shivchi Kamayim Libech Nochach Pnei Adonai, pour out your heart like water, is a key pasuk in understanding what the sentiments of Echa are. And it also points to one of the several unique features of Echa, which is in practice, that Echa is the only Megillah where its chief reading, and really its only reading, is at night. All Megillot are read during the day, and as we've seen several times around Purim time, even Megillat Esther, its main reading is during the day. The night reading is maybe from post-Tanaitic time, it certainly is minor relative to the daytime reading. Echa is only read at night, and so Kumi Roni Balayla seems to be the source text for that. So I picked that for the phrase. Just the historic setting. Why was the Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Anytime you have this discussion, it depends very much if you're discussing Megillat Echa or Midrash Echa. Midrash Echa, which of course is a post-destruction Midrash, is perhaps the most beautiful piece of literature that we have in all of rabbinic literature. The collection of all of rabbinic literature. It is amazing. It's gorgeous. It's very, very sad, obviously. But Midrash Echa. Midrash Eicha may be the most beautiful collection of rabbinic literature that we have. Of course, that's an issue of taste also. But some of the most famous passages we have come from Midrash Eicha, a famous one about each one of the Avot coming to Hashem and asking him to forgive Bnei Yisrael. And finally, it's Rachel, that she was willing to give up her simanim, not to embarrass her sister, whose schut saves Am Yisrael. Some of the most gorgeous passages come from there, and it's the creativity of pain that's really powerful. Midrash Eicha, you can only speak about really two major events and a lot of minor events, and that is the destruction of Yehuda and Beitar. And because that's all after Beitar. And so that's what the setting is. But when you're talking about Megillat Eicha, there's only one thing you're talking about, that's the destruction of Yerushalayim. Why was Yerushalayim destroyed in the year 586 BCE? So you can give all sorts of theological explanations, but if you ask a historian, what will he tell you? Right? So the answer is actually straightforward, which is that the Babylonians who were moving westward, because you have to remember, if you live in the middle, any time until the Persians, if you're living in Israel, any time during that period, you are in the middle of a war zone. The war zone's always between Egypt and whoever is ascendant in the east. And they're always at each other, and you're in the middle. And if you're smart, you stay out of their way. And if you're not smart, like you make not a great move like Yoshiel makes, and you try to get involved, you get killed. That's, of course, the famous passage of Yahu wailing for Yoshiel. And what happened is the Babylonians, who beat up on the Assyrians in about the year 610 BCE, and then started marching westward, of course, Egypt is the goal, come and conquer Yerushalayim in the year 597 BCE. They take all of the aristocracy and send them away in chains. They take the king, Yehoiachin. And he's in club fed. He's in a nice prison there. But in the meantime, there is still a community. There's a Beit HaMikdash. They're operating. And just you be good guys. And they appoint a member of David's family, member of the royal family, by the name of Matanya. And they change his name to Tzidkiah and appoint him as their puppet king. And they say, you be a good boy and everything will be fine. And he was surrounded by all sorts of what we refer to as Nevi'i Sheker. There was the lead spokesman who claimed to be prophets, who told him that Babel is going down, and if you sign a treaty with Egypt, Egypt will come to your aid, and therefore they even were telling the Jews who had been exiled to Babel, sit on your suitcases because you're coming home. Yirmiyahu was the one Navi at the time who was telling Tzidkiyahu that ain't the way it is, and you have to submit to Babel, and it's going to be for a while. And he sent the famous letter in Parakhaftet to the Jews in the Gola saying, settle down, buy land, plant gardens, marry your daughters off, take daughters for your sons, right? You'll be there. And later you will come back. And that's why Yirmiyahu himself buys land in Israel as demonstration of the fact that we know we're coming back, but not so quick. Tzidkiyahu makes the terrible mistake of believing everybody else. Signs an agreement with Egypt. The Babylonians say, you're not a good boy. You didn't do what you're supposed to do. Babylonian comes and destroys. And Yirmiyahu then is wailing. So why is Yirmiyahu assumed to be the author of Eicha? For several reasons. First of all, because he's the only true prophet that we know of who was around at the time. Second of all is because there's a lot of common language between the book of Yirmiyahu and the book of Eicha. Right? Including even the term Eicha that shows up. Yeah. Just to add to that, is that, and this is probably the most powerful point, is that Paragimel, which we'll get to in a couple weeks, Paragimel is an autobiographical parak in the first person singular, Ani HaGever, which does not start with the Aleph of Eicha, but with Ani, and it describes events that are matched perfectly with Yirmiyahu's life, as we know from Sefer Yirmiyahu. So he seems very much to be the author. However, when you look at the fifth parak, you have to have a whole different approach to who wrote it and when, because the fifth parak is written from the perspective of a destruction that happened a long time ago or a while ago, not that's happened in front of our eyes. Last point about that is that I'm sorry, Jason, you had a question.
I was just going to say, in 1998, there was a movie called Jeremiah that was played by...
All right, so the structure itself of Eicha, which is five chapters, Again, chapter 1, 2, and 4, all 22 long verses in the Kinam meter following the alphabet, the third chapter being three Aleph Bets, as it were, and the last chapter being 22 Psukim, but not with any particular order, is something that obviously, and by the way, that's where my starting point is that it becomes very easy to talk about Perek Aleph Bet, Gimel, Dalet, and Hey without having to say, yeah, but that's the Christian division. It's kind of an obvious division. As opposed to, let's say, root. When you look at root, the four chapters are pretty reasonable divisions, but if you look in a Megillat root, you see it's all one story, except for that little epilogue at the end with the generations. It's all one parsha. Here, almost every pasuk is a parsha by itself, as you could see on this handout. That's what it looks like in Megillat Eicha. By the way, has anybody ever heard Eicha read from a Megillah? In Shalom, the Minhag is to read it with a Megillah. The one difference is that they say the Brachah Mikra Megillah, and they do not say Shachianu, because obviously not going to say Shachianu over Tisha B'Av. Okay, so the Midrash has several approaches to understanding what the structure is. And the starting point has got to be also, why, forget about the five chapters, etc., but why is any chapter ever in an Abecedarian acrostic? Why would it be an Aleph Bet, or familiar with Ashrei? Why would it be that way? So one is symbolic and encompasses everything. What's another possibility?
Easy to remember.
Exactly. Easy to remember and easy for public recitation. Okay, I ask you, what's next? Right, we all know it. Right, but if I were to give you another perek, right, you know tzaku because you know the tzadi. Pei tzadi. So easy. Right? Sophia. And you don't have to say Shulchayel each week to know it. You know, pay tzadi. Kind of easy to remember. And it makes it easy to remember. And often when you have a song, you know, or a poem, if you ever had to memorize long poems in high school, in college, then in high school, then it's often easy if you can remember the first word in the line that sets you off on the line. So that's helpful. So you see both of those approaches in this Midrash. But Pinchas Patach. Now, Patach is something we talked about a couple years ago in the context of Midrash Eicha. One of the most beautiful elements of Midrash Eicha, something that exists in other Midrashim, but in Eicha, it's a huge collection. It's called a Ptichta. Ptichta is called a proem, P-R-O-E-M. And what it means is an introductory Midrash that works in an opposite way of most Midrashim. Most Midrashim you're familiar with start with a key pasuk and wend their way to a message. Here it starts with some other pasuk, has a whole message, and ends with the pasuk that you're going to read. So all the Ptichtaot of Eicha start with whatever other pasuk and a long story, et cetera, and ends with Al Kain, Konein, Yirmiyahu, Eicha. And what you can imagine is everybody's gathered to read Eicha, and the Darshan is giving this introduction and leading you right into, and right away you go Eicha Yashva Badad. So right, Pinchas Patach, this is how Pinchas opened up his, or introduced his drasha on pre-Eicha. Im ad ele lo tishmuli, and often the darshanim on Eicha, meaning pre the reading of Eicha, would begin with one of the psukim of chastisement and rebuke in the Torah, either in Vayikra or in Dvarim, or from passages from Yirmiyahu. If you do not listen to me, then I'm going to afflict you seven times over. That's in Bechukotai. The number seven keeps playing in Bechukotai. Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua. So Rabbi Pinchas quotes a machloka between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Those are end of first century. It was right after the destruction. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mevi Puraniyot Al Yisrael Ad Shemeid Ben Tchila. Right? He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu never punishes until he testifies first. How do we know it? Vim Ad Eile. How do you read the word Ad? Vim Eid Eile. Okay, a little drasha. Yeshua Omer, Shelo Yisrael Omrim Kalu Makot Od Ein Lanu Achirot Lavi Aleinu. Am Yisrael shouldn't turn around and say, this is why he says Ad Eile. He says, don't think that Am Yisrael shouldn't turn around and say, oh, God's used up all of his punishments. We're all out of punishments now. We can have fun and do whatever you want. If you haven't listened till now, meaning, I have more than this that I can bring. And then what does he say at the end of the pasuk? I'm going to afflict you seven times over. Atem avartem lefanai sheva averot. Now, it's unclear what these seven sins are, whether they have to do with Shemitah, which is the context there. And by the way, which Yirmiyahu ties into the destruction of the first Mikdash. Bo v'kablu aleichem sheva puraniyot, accept seven punishments. Atem avartem lefanai sheva averot. And again, Harimiyahu Baba Koneinu Lechem Kinochu Sheva Alpha Beitin. So now, how do they work it in? Yirmiyahu comes and gives you seven alphabets of chastisement and of dirging. Sorry. What are the seven? Chapter 1, chapter 2, 3 in chapter 3, chapter 4, and then they're conveniently calling chapter 5 an alphabet, even though there is no alphabet there. Why? Because it's 22 psukim. So it's like the seven alphabets in Echa to kind of respond to the seven punishments that you're getting. That's position one. So that would be like what Ariel was saying, which is that it is symbolic of response. In this other midrash in Echa, Mneiman Neimar Megillah Kinot Alpha Beta, why was Echa written in Aleph Bet? In Echem Rabbanan, we have three opinions, but the only one that speaks to us. You know, Meir, Lefish Katuv V'chol Yisrael Avru Toratecha. This is in the Navi turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It sounds like kind of imitating what Eliyahu says. They've all left your Torah. Shiktuva mi'alaf yad tav. And this is very much what Ariel is saying, is that the Torah goes from Aleph to Tav. And so therefore, lefichach nichtava megillah zot alpha beit in zu keneged zu. Therefore, it's written in Aleph Bet. Now, both of these are symbolic. One speaks to the amount of the alphabets, seven of them. The other is to the very fact of the Aleph Bet, that it encompasses everything. But then there is what David said. V'lama nichtav kol ha-sefer hazeh kisidur chav bet otiyot sheba Aleph Bet. This in Otsar Midrashim. This is a later midrash. V'shvil sh'yeh ha-sefer hazeh muchan v'ragil l'chol Yisrael b'fiyam. Should be very easy for everybody to say. Which is an interesting note, because what's the one place where the text itself tells us, know how to say this by heart, so that it would be very easy testimony against yourself? That's Hazinu. You're supposed to learn Hazinu by heart, so that when all these bad things befall you, you will say it will be a testimony against you, and you realize this is why all this stuff has happened, right? So here the Midrash picks up the same thread and weaves it into Echa and said, why do we want Echa to be Aleph Bet? So be very easy for people to say. Keshem shenemar la shira gdola, that's Hazinu, v'atak yitvu lachem at ha-shira hazot. So just like you have to know Hazinu by heart, you have to know Echa by heart kiilu. Not by heart, but it should be easy to you for you to respond with. The notion is that when good things happen, it's very easy to gather together and have a leader and respond, call and response. Hallel, nobody ever said you have to know Hallel by heart. But when there's sadness, often you're desolate, you're on your own. It should be easy for you to draw on sources of expression of this dirge. Now, the one other thing about the structure that is interesting about this Payayin reversal. So there's a midrash here that speaks back to what is rabbinically and midrashically the source of Tisha B'Av. So the source of Tisha B'Av is not really the right word, but sort of the core of Tisha B'Av as a day of punishment. And what do Chazal connect Tisha B'Av to? What historic event? It is the quote-unquote miraglim. Right, the scouts came back and they gave the report, and everybody freaked out. Everybody's screaming and crying that night. What is the famous drush of Rabbah? Oto laila leil tisha b'av haya. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Baran Tanit. God said, "Atem bechitem bechia al chinam. You cried for naught. Ani kovei alechem bechia l'dorot. I'm going to make this a night of weeping for generations." And that's, again, part of the Kumi Roni Balayla, the idea of weeping at night. Night is also a time of isolation. Kumi in the singular, Roni Balayla. And so the notion here is that the Meraglim, as they're called, spoke before they took a look at what was happening. The order in the alphabet that we have is Mem Nun Samach Ayin Pei. I was thinking, what is an ayin? An ayin is an eye. What is a pei? It's a mouth. So it means first you look and you think and kind of look ahead and think what's going to happen, then you speak. Right? We're all familiar with a filter. You filter out what you're going to say. And the idea is, la maitim pe la ayin, lefishayu omrim b'fiyem mashalo ra'u b'enehem. Here it's an even stronger statement, is that ultimately the 10 guys said stuff they didn't even see. If they exaggerated and reported stuff they didn't see, and that's what led to the tragedy. So because of that, to remember it, the pay and ayin are switched. However, we have a much more likely explanation for why the pay and ayin are separated. As you know, we found lots and lots of artifacts from Beit Rishon times, a little bit from pre-Beit Rishon times, but the exciting stuff that we found for the most part has been from that 10th to 6th century BCE. And one of the most common things that we found of archives, not of artifacts, meaning of written things, have been writing exercises. And these bit chart that we found this goes back, 10th century BC, I believe. And it's all, of course, in Paleo-Hebrew. And we found alphabets that are written by students, evidently practicing their writing. And interesting that in some of the cases, the alphabet goes left to right. There's another thing about the alphabet we'll talk about in the next session. But in many of the alphabet exercises they have, the order is Pei-Ayin, which tells you that the order of the alphabet was either not yet determined or there was a variant order in which the Pei came before the Ayin at the time of Beit Rishon, which would be Yirmiyahu.
Every other time we have, like, Tehillim, where it goes in order.
Yeah, good. So if you take a look at some of the Tehillim that we have, and a really good example that's actually Eshet Chayil, you could see that there are places, first of all, where the Pei is missing in acrostics, right? Like, for instance, in Chafei, right? And where the Pei and Ayin seem to not make sense in the order that they're in. So, for instance, in the Septuagint version of Eshet Chayil, the Pei and Ayin are switched. Right? Eshet Chayil is Mishlei, so we'll give that to Chizkiyahu, at least the very end of it. Right? But the Pei and Ayin, in their translation, are switched because it seems to actually flow a little bit better, the Pei being in front of the Ayin. And in several of the other Prakim of Tehillim that you see, where you have the Ayin and Pei, so, for instance, in Lamed Dalet, if you look at Lamed Dalet, you could see that it actually flows better if the Pei is before the Ayin. So does it mean that at some later point before canonization it was fixed that Ayin comes before Pei, and therefore they switch things? Unclear. I'm not going to take a position on that. But the Ayin Pei order is the Pei Ayin order is very well attested. Eicha is the clearest proof because you have three the chapter 2 and 3 times 3 and 4 are all Pei than Ayin. And you have all of these artifacts that we found where Pei comes before Ayin. It's mixed. The bottom line is, if you think about it, there is no reason to have an order to an alphabet. Why would you have an order to an alphabet? There's only one good reason to have an order to an alphabet, and that is exactly for scribal exercises.
Gematria?
Right? Yeah, so gematria is a much, much later push into the text, which is not inherent in the text.
But what happened there with the gematria?
What?
If they switched, wouldn't it change?
Right, which tells you all you need to know. Right, exactly. Okay. I mean, you know, again, it gematria is, as Chazal say, parperet l'chokhmah. A cute little, like, a nice little device. It's a good way to remember certain things. All right? It's a good way to remember an association. Avraham 248, Ramach mitzvot aseh. It's a good way to remember it. But more than that, taking it more seriously than that is very troubling. Right, and you could end up with all sorts of bizarre things and things that I'll say off a record when we're done, which will give you a good laugh, but I don't want anyone else to hear. Just one other piece I want to show you is this whole notion of a public reading. There is no mention anywhere in the Gemara about reading Megillat Eicha publicly. In fact, the only Megillah that's mentioned anywhere in the sources, in the rabbinic sources, to be read publicly is, of course, Megillat Esther, of which we have a whole Masechet, sort of. We have a few Mishnayot about that. However, in Masechet Sofrim, which we've dealt with in the past, even in the context of Esther, Megillat Esther at night, you have the following. Yesh Shekorin Sefer Kinot Ba'erev. Now, this is 8th century, and notice what they're saying. Some people read Eicha at night, and they're still calling it Kinot, by the way. Why did the stop getting called keynote, and why do we refer to it as Eicha? Because in rabbinic literature it's called keynote. Probably because once the Kina literature got going and all of the keynote were assembled as a way of distinguishing, we referred to it as Eicha. One small note about keynote is that the keynote that we say, that huge collection of keynote, that either you say it all without paying attention, or else you say a few. I mean, I don't know anybody who can go through the whole thing on Tisha B'Av fasting and actually be paying attention to all of the words. Very hard words, very hard stuff. But if you're able to, Shrecha. But the keynote were originally written as, like some of the Paitanim, as really this year's Kina. In other words, it wasn't like, let's keep adding, but it's like, this is this year's Kina. And the keynote, by the way, were originally written to be said within tefillah, within Shemona Esrei. Not as a separate, after you finish and you sit down. It's a later development. But as keynotes suddenly became a collection, very likely that's why at some point they began referring to our book as Eichat. Yesh Akorin Sefer Keynote Ba'erev. Some people read it at night. V'yesh Ma'acharin Araboker. Some people will only read it in the morning. L'achar Kriyat Torah. Shalachar Kriyat Torah Omeid V'roshomit Palesh B'yafer V'gadam V'fulashin V'korei B'vchiyah V'yelalah. The idea is that according to this tradition, where they would only read Eicha in the morning after Kriya, and the idea is that by that time you're really into the fast, and you're really feeling terrible, and then you're going to really weep. As opposed to at night, you think about it, you just had a pretty decent meal, and you're not fully into... The idea is you should be fully into the morning when you read Eicha. Im yodea hu letargumo mutav, if you know how to translate it, that's fine. Vim lav, no no lemishi yodea letargem. Betov umetargem lefishi avinu bo shar ha'am. Everybody should understand what it says. So according to this, it should be translated. V'tino kocha anashim chayavot lishma kriyat sefer kanashim mechol shekein zecharim. Everybody, women and men, all have to hear Eicha, and they have to understand what's being said. So it's important to translate for them what's going on. By the way, Eicha has somewhat difficult language, somewhat challenging language, which we'll see in the future weeks. I think we won't get into to the parak itself. I will just point out one interesting thing about the alphabet and about acrostics. You notice that, of course, our parak follows what's called, formerly, an abecedarian acrostic. An abecedarian means A, B, C, D. That's a real word. It's great for Scrabble. Anyhow, too many letters, but, if you have something set up. However, there was, and this would get back to Tehillim, there was an article written, I'm thinking about 20 years ago, by my cousin, Chanan Eshel, Zichro Livracha, about an ostracon that was found. This is something Kugan reported on years ago. An ostracon that was found in which there was a writing exercise in which it started Lamed Mem Nun Samach Pei Ayin, Tzadi Kufrei Shin Tav, and then Aleph Bet Gimel Dal. So it started from Lamed, went to the end, then started from Aleph Bet. And this supported the idea that we have in several languages where there seem to be two different alphabets working. One starts alphabet, the other one that seems to start in the middle. What's our middle? And in Latin, there's even a reference to this because they would refer to it as an elementa. That's, by the way, where the word elementary comes from, L-M-N. It would start just like A, B, C, D, it would start L-M-N. And their argument was that if you take a look at Tehillim, and take a look when you have a chance at home, at Tehillim, Tet and Yod. Tet and Yod together on acrostic. Tet starts with an Aleph, and then Yod starts with a Lamed. And, it's like every two or three psukim is a new letter. And it goes through an acrostic, but the thing is a little weird, because Parak Tet thanks God for taking care of all the Rishayim, and Yod is a plea to God to take care of the Rishayim. You think about how backwards that is. So Hanan, Zichro Livracha, suggested that really Tet Yod were reversed. And that really originally, Lama, which is the beginning of Yod, was really the beginning of the first chapter. Hashem, please, stop these evil doers. And then when the decision was made that the alphabet only starts with an Aleph, so it was reversed. And he explained several things that way. If you take a look at this parak, you will see that it operates in a sort of two wheels, and either one could be the starting place. And what we'll do it next time that we learn, we'll meet in 2 weeks, because next week I'll be in New York, is that you could actually see it as starting from the Lamed or starting from the Aleph. And they both work elegantly as an interaction between the Mekonen, the dirger, and the city itself. And that dialogue going on. So we'll see that next week.